Fair. It is 4:08 on February the 13th, 1990. I'm interviewing for the first time Patrick King. This interview is taking place at the office of Patrick King at 2406 Broadway. This is part of the Vietnam Archive Oral History Project at Texas Tech University. The first thing I'd like to ask you is perhaps, how did you get into Vietnam? How did you initially get into the Marines?
Well, I went to college from 64 to 68. And of course, the 60s was a really strange time. The war had been kicking off since 62, but nobody was really aware of it until 64, 65. And I had been air officer, I'd been planning on flying since I was about 5 years old. So I had taken all my Navy tests, and I was an air officer candidate. I was draft exempt as long as I maintained C's in college. Graduated from college in 1968. But because of the Tet Offensive, the Navy and the Marine Corps especially lost a lot of pilots in the war. So the pipeline in Pensacola was full, and I could not get to Pensacola in September like I was supposed to. It would take me in January. In the meantime, the Army drafted me. And back then, you had no choice. And they wanted me to go. I met a Marine Corps recruiter. I don't know if that was the best thing I ever did, but I met a Marine Corps recruiter. He said, I can get you in. And I was the first and only officer that was sworn in Beaufort, South Carolina at the air station there. I went to officer candidate school in Quantico, Virginia. While I was there, Pensacola was still full. Marine Corps was hurting for helicopter pilots especially. It gave us a big, huge speech. And they had this program to where they would handpick four guys out of each class that were Air Officer candidates, usually about 20 in each class. Two go to the Air Force, two go to the Army. Get their Air Force or Army wings, come out, get their Navy wings, and go to Vietnam. All Marine Corps officers are basically trained to be ground pounders too, which is different than other services. And I decided that if I was going to be in the war, back at that time, helicopter pilots were looked at as really gutsy. In fact, even today, when you look at air in Vietnam, there's all types of air, but there's something, the mystique of Vietnam is the helicopters, and there's a thing about that. So I volunteered a helicopter as much to my parents' terror, I guess. Got selected, went to Army Flight School in Texas, in Mineral Wells, then back to Hunter on Airfield in Savannah, Georgia. Went to Greenbrae Jungle Survival School. Got my Army wings, went to North Carolina, transition instrument training, got my Navy wings. I'm a certified co-pilot and went to Vietnam.
Great. And what was, after getting to Vietnam, what were some of your initial impressions once you were in country?
Well, the tapes I was talking about earlier, it's really kind of strange. You listen to the first tape, you have a 23-year-old, very cocky young American, Marine Corps second lieutenant, naval aviator, the best of the best and all that sort of thing. Couldn't stand Vietnamese. Prior to going to Vietnam, I went and saw the movie Woodstock, and I was involved, we weren't allowed to go, it was off limits, but I went anyway to Washington, D.C., was involved in both the peace marches, not as a participant, just being there, seeing it. I began to have grave doubts at that point about the war. Prior to that, I just wanted to be a pilot, get my wings, and go fight in the war like John Wayne, a whole bit, like a lot of guys did. Raised a middle-class American family, felt that it was my duty to do this sort of thing, but would never thought of evading the draft. But this point, I started to get really kind of concerned. And then, to add on top of that, is the fact that I was the gold wings, the sports car, the wallet, the money in it. You know, walk into a bar. I wasn't a Christian. Time to walk into a bar and say, "Excuse me, my dears, I'm not this tall as my wallet I'm sitting on." You know, that type of attitude. All of a sudden, I have to pay for all that: the college education, the gold wings, the dress blue uniforms, the BOQ, the traveling, my own airplanes, my name on all that stuff. All of a sudden, I had to go in country, and now that Uncle Sam's saying, "Now I want you to pay for what you've done." Listen to my last tape. It's only 20 minutes long. Day before I left Vietnam, staying in my hooch, overlooking the Da Nang Valley and the city of Da Nang and the harbor, and behind me is the mountains and Sherwood Forest and Baghdad country. And I'm staying there next to my bunk. I'm the only one left in that area. My roommates are all gone. I was the fourth to the last Marine Corps officer to leave Vietnam. The Marine Corps left in April. They formed a thing called the 3rd Marine Amphibious Brigade. There were 6 officers and 100 men. I was the fourth, the last Marine officer to leave in country, Vietnam proper. And this tape is different guy. The voice sounds older, sounds tired. His whole view on life has changed. And if you listen to those tapes all the way through, it takes about 6 hours. You couldn't equate the first, that kid and the guy a year older who's lost his roommate to his best friends, killed a bunch of people, seen a bunch of awful things, and had it pretty easy in some ways too. That's basically what's going on. That was my feelings at that time.
And you flew helos. What were your primary missions as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam.
Okay, I did two things in Vietnam. I started out from July of 1970 into February of 1971. I flew with a squadron called HML-167, which is Marine Light Helicopter Squadron 167. They're no longer HMLs in the Marine Corps, they're called HMAs, attack squadrons, made up of Cobras mostly, which is a skinny. The Hiva gunship, the reason I got in that, I went to Vietnam trained as a medium lift helicopter pilot, the big tandem rotor helicopter. When I got to Vietnam, they had just lost two crashes in this Huey squadron. And my orders came through and said, hey, this guy's an Army trained pilot. He's got 150 hours in Hueys. He's already trained with the Army, worked with them, we'll do a lot of liaison with them. Let's put him in this squadron. And I walked in, and I already had enough training. I wasn't prepared for what was going to happen. But I got in there and I flew. We had a number of different missions. Everything is flagged out of Saigon. The Air Force handles all the orders. In other words, you were told what you would fly. It wasn't one of these things you just get up in the morning and go fly where you want. We had missions we called Ass and Trash, which was just hauling people and gear. Boring. Now, flying gunships, we didn't haul the people. The Huey gunship was like a fighter plane. We had two 20-shot rocket pods on each side, two M60 machine guns on each side. Carried 8,000 rounds of 7.62 millimeter rounds, all tracers, so you can see them better at night. And we carried a mix in the rocket pods depending on the mission. Usually half Willy Peak, white phosphorus for spotting LZs and things, half HE, high explosive. Of course, the gun platform, you're only doing 140 knots in a dive, so it wasn't a real stable rocket platform. I mean, anybody could say they could put one in a window. It was really kind of blowing smoke because you had to be careful. You get pretty good at it, but even then, you couldn't guarantee that you could hit this building from a mile away because those rockets, they're designed to go off much faster, more like 200 knots, and they're spin fin stabilized, so the rocket kind of comes out and wobbles a little bit, and if you're low at 200 feet, 400 feet away, no telling. We flew gun cover for us. If they weren't out taking mail or taking troops or transferring guys, we went out and covered. We flew ahead like a fighter plane in a section of two, a wingman and a lead. The lead always ran the mission. Crew of four in each one, door gunner, crew chief, co-pilot, pilot. So we hauled gear for people. We did rocket belt VRs. We went out every morning and every night to look for North Vietnamese. When I was there fighting very few Viet Cong. Where I was in I Corps, which is up right from the DMZ, down past Chu Lai a little bit, that's I Corps, down the Khe San Mountains, and Quang Nam and Tao Tien provinces and Quang Tri provinces where we were. Basically, we would look for those 122mm rockets they're firing, those big ones, and we would look for that. We'd see guys in the open, we'd greet them. Unfortunately, the interesting thing was that quite often we were controlled by a unit called Da Nang Dasc in Da Nang, and we had a secure radio. It was a secure thing. We called Da Nang Dasc and said, we've got two gunners in the open. One of them was carrying the back section of a 122mm rocket. They just DD'd over behind, DD means to move real quick, behind a pile of rocks. Request permission to waste them. They said, wait one. They have to call the village chieftain and the local province guy and get permission. Quite often they come back and say, no, you can't do it. We had ways of working with that. The crew chief, and we would do this among ourselves. It wasn't pre-briefed in the open. It was all once you knew your crew. He'd say, I got a hang fire, sir, and he'd burst out his machine gun. So just, my weapon froze up on me, sir, and we'd grease him and leave him. I had a friend one time that his roommate and him got a couple of them in the open, and they dropped their weapons and started to run. They flew the helicopter. He'd tackle them outside the helicopter 40 miles an hour, captured them both, which made everybody mad. Other guys would take their pistols and shoot them out the window. Sometimes we just leave. I had actually had times on rocket belt VRs where we'd be orbiting the area and we couldn't get permission to shoot. There was too many bills around and stuff and too many people in the area, too many people on the radio net. We'd fly by low and they'd wave at us and walk off in the bush. And usually the crew chief would flip them off and just say, we'll get you next time. And it was a game we both knew. I had great respect always for the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. I hated some of the things they did, but even to this day, I have great respect. They're just as tough as they come. I also believe that the Army that fought in Vietnam and the Marine Corps is the best the country's ever had. I think we were good at what we did. So we did rocket belt VRs. We also did hunter killer teams, two gunships and a Loach, a small Hughes 500 aircraft called the LOH. Had a Marine Corps observer and an Army pilot and sitting in the back seat in the floor with a bungee cord and M60 via door gunner. And we'd snoop and poop in the area. We had these free fire zones, drop leaflets, get everybody out, let it clear everybody out, and we had these big, huge areas that might cover the size of Lubbock, and they're marked in grids. You take Hunter Carotene out, and you just get in one corner, and you start flying down. Anything in there. Birds, water buffaloes, dogs, cats, men, women, children. Any poor farmer left out there didn't get the word, you grease them. You have to ask for permission enough, and they're free fire zones. And those little LOHs will go out there and snoop and poop, and they find a big rice cache, they drop a C4 grenade or any number of things in there, burn it up, blow it up with a C4, whatever it was they were using, or a pyrotechnic grenade to get it caught. Or they'd smoke it and we'd hose it, shoot up sand pans in water and stuff like that. That was another mission we did. Troop insertions, major assaults where the Marine Corps would head out in the Thule's toward Laos and that sort of thing, and they would drop troops in, and we would prep the area and then cover them when they land and then stick around for medevacs afterwards. Then another thing we did was working with recon teams. Marine Corps had our recon teams were similar. People say they're similar to Green Beret. They aren't. Green Beret were more worked in the pacification program, worked in local hamlets with popular forces and kept it secure. Our recon team corresponds to the Army Alert program. Specialized teams, radio operator, medic, sniper, all that. And their whole thing was to go out in the bush and do intelligence work, not mix it up with them. And we were dropping those guys in Laos at a time we weren't supposed to. They would brief us before the mission and say, you're going into Laos today. We asked for volunteers. You just volunteered. If you crash in Vietnam, we will try to recover your body and dump it on the Vietnam side and tell your parents you're killed in Vietnam. If you do die or they can't recover the body, say it was an accident and you drifted off course. There will be no, we did not get air medals. That was a lot of guys that met. To get an air medal, you got to get fired upon 3 times, return fire 3 times in a hazardous area. Any missions in Vietnam, you didn't get those. Didn't count because you weren't supposed to be there. The President of the United States and Congress said you can't be there. We were flying there all the time. I don't think it's wrong. We had to. That's where the stuff was coming from. So that makes sense. And finally, the last thing we did, the most important and the scariest and the roughest, was medevac. Night medevac and day medevac. Medevac missions from Marine Corps ran from 6 in the morning to 6 at night. That was one group from 6 at night to 6 in the morning. 3 types of medevac. Emergency medevac, guys close to dying. Routine medevacs where a guy is got bit by a snake, broke his leg, something like that. And the permanent routine, he's already dead. We say the permanent routine is in the morning. Like, in other words, if a team comes on, we take off and go out and pick up all the dead bodies. And we don't pick them up. We flew gun cover for them. Medevacs were the most important because time was an essence. In Vietnam, I mean, most of the area, we could get a guy that from the point he got hit to his on the operating table back in Da Nang at the most 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And a lot of times we didn't make it. The guy died. And I've been on missions where a helicopter gets shot down and kills 6 people to save one guy that lost his foot. But you can't send them out there unless you want them. So, it worked the Army, too. I have great respect. Da Nang dust off. They didn't have gun cover. And I've been in plenty of hot LZs where we got our fannies shot off. And you see those guys going by themselves. And we try to break off and cover them, too. And those guys were guts. I mean, they were just excellent. But that's kind of the missions we flew.
And what was your general impression on how the war was run?
It's been quoted, and it's true. We never lost a battle in Vietnam. I never was in an engagement we didn't kick the fire out of them. And I don't mean just like they show up, kill some of us, and they disappear. We always kick tail. The gunships were pretty awesome to the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. They had great respect for them. They called them dragons, and they hated them. But sometimes, get them in a corner, they fight back. There have been accounts in my squadron where a guy came back in, just totally out of it, saying, caught a Viet Cong in the open today. Guy stood there with a single bolt rifle in the middle of a rice paddy firing on a gunship rolling in with all that firepower and just kept shooting until they cut into pieces. You know, they were awesome. They were dedicated. And But I didn't agree. The interesting thing is the Marine Corps had a pacification program that really worked. It was a thing we needed to do for everybody. People in the Marine Corps are all the killers. The Marine Corps came out of Vietnam smelling like a rose. Even though our mission is not Marine Corps is designed to do amphibious assaults, go far enough inland to secure a place where they can build a runway, let the Army come in. The Marine Corps spent 11, 12 years in Vietnam with equipment that was designed for short-time stuff. I was using World War II 45 holster and cartridge belt and old weapons and things, you know, in Vietnam. Politically, a lot of books you read today, General Giac, the North Vietnamese, who was the mastermind of Dien Bien Phu, the French, and later the Tet Offensive. I'll tell you, the Tet Offensive was a major failure as a military. Walter Cronkite has since recanted. You get that famous speech, there's no light at the end of the tunnel. He has since, on that Vietnam CBS series at the very end, has said, I was wrong. But it was because Walter Cronkite said what he said, who people respected, and other people, but the American people, as Gap said, the American people. Even there's a number of North Vietnamese don't want to admit that that happened, but Tet was a total failure. We destroyed almost 68% of the infrastructure of the Viet Cong, and we destroyed almost 45% of the North Vietnamese capability. Had we continued on the war, we would have stopped it. Also, never bombing the Red River dikes and basically industrially shutting down North Vietnam. This idea, I don't believe Kissinger shut people from think he was. This idea of negotiated peace, building off a major war, just doesn't compute. And then the Church Amendment came out where it started cutting back our supplies. My mother said, isn't this great? I said, yeah, we're fighting the same war with less stuff and less people and less equipment. I mean, and guys are dying over this thing. So I think we finally, at this day and age, separated the war from the warrior. And the warrior was excellent. The war, it didn't make sense. Of course, we were fighting a war that was very difficult. It was a guerrilla war. You know, in the daytime, we owned it. Nighttime, they owned it. We came inside our bases at night and shut down. Locked the gates, put our perimeters up, sent Air Force Spectre gunships out. We flew missions at night. Air Force did some bombing, did interdiction artillery stuff all night long. I mean, every night with the base, boom, boom in the distance. When I came back to the States, it's one of the things I had a hard time sleeping my first couple of weeks because I couldn't hear it. I didn't hear helicopters go over, I couldn't hear the artillery all the time in the background. But well, I think we fought it. I think Westmoreland did. These guys had all come out of the Korean World War II conflict. They had no concept of what was happening, and I think we wasted a lot of people's lives. One of the things is very clear, when you, even when you're doing your interviews, I can't tell you what Vietnam was like only from the view of a Marine Corps helicopter pilot, which is just one small, tiny sliver of the whole picture of Vietnam. A riverine boat captain says, Vietnam is this. No, that's what Vietnam was for him. That's his sliver. A grunt in the bush in the Central Highlands is one sliver. Now, you take all that, the war from 62 to 66 was a different war, or 68, from the war from 68 to 72. Back when the Blues in the Central Highlands, an army unit, those guys kicked tail and took names. I've never heard that expression before. Basically, what it means is to wipe a unit out to where they no longer exist, you take their name away from them. That's what it means. Well, the Blues, the Highland Blues, they were awesome. Guys who fought their first tour as the Blues, who were just beating up people wherever they went, came back after 68, and it was a different story altogether. So it's a number of different wars by a big global view. A cook in the Idrang Valley, in the Iron Triangle, a radio operator on Hamburger Hill, a Marine at Khe Sanh, each could do an interview with you and say, this is Vietnam, but in reality, that's just Vietnam for him. Vietnam is a huge kaleidoscope of things. And I think that we just didn't fight it correctly. I still believe it was right. I still believe, I could tell you some other time, my last day in Vietnam, I was getting ready to get in a Jeep, as I stood on Highway 1 looking toward the north, what I was thinking one time. But anyway, go ahead, you got a question.
That was just, that's real good. I was going to get your general impression of, was there a lot of corruption in the South Vietnamese government, and did you feel like you were really fighting for an appropriate cause? That corruption, or did you question that at times?
Yeah, I question a lot. As you know, probably doing some studying and reading, the average American soldier and officer had little or no respect for the Vietnamese Army, the ARVN. Had great respect for the Vietnamese Marine Corps. I can't think of the name of the unit, but after in 1975, when the North came down into the South, there was a Ranger Battalion of South Vietnamese that almost died to the man. And took the North Vietnamese a number of days to get through those people. There was excellent individual units. But by and large, wouldn't give you a nickel for an ARVN soldier. They had the ascots and the jungle boots and the shiny M16s, but they didn't want to fight. A lot of people say that Vietnam was a revolution. That was a uniting of a common people. I don't agree with that. The people of the South and the people of the North are two different kinds of people. It's always been that way in their culture. You know, they're united by the French colonialism. Now, I will say this. I believe that our support of the French after the Geneva Convention and after World War II was wrong. To support colonialism back there, we shot ourselves in the foot and shot every guy on the wall in Washington, D.C. in the back. In my opinion, by doing that, they had fought against the Japanese, and all of a sudden, the war is over, they got the independence. You know, Nguyen Ai Quoc, who was known as Ho Chi Minh, people like that. All of a sudden, we come in and put the French right back in, colonialism starts. There's no reason why they wouldn't hate us. Because we were freedom. But that was our ally, De Gaulle and all that, you know, and all that kind of garbage. But somehow in all this, as we did all this sort of thing, we missed the boat in that. Rephrase that question again. I want to make sure I get through
it. I was just trying to get your general impressions on the South Vietnamese government, and if it was evident that they were corrupt, or was it maybe they were just kind of giving a bad light of...
I think it's really both. There's bad press. There were excellent army units, the Air Force, the Vietnamese Air Force did some wonderful stuff. When the brothers were both killed, Madam New's husband and his brother were killed, and it says that Kennedy was just distraught when it happened. I'm not convinced that Kennedy went in on it when they allowed that coup. It was military coup after military coup, and they're found murdered in the back of an APC, and we didn't know about it. Either we're very stupid, or want to get rid of them, because the whole thing with the Buddhists and all this and our image. We're so worried about the world was thinking, we forgot we were fighting a war. And we're friendly American soldiers in here. The South Vietnamese also, one of the difficulties is there's a whole different thing on hubris and pride between the American and them. To see, for example, a helicopter land and a bunch of villagers, and these little kids, I'm talking out in the bush, I'm not down around the cities, but out in the bush, and see little kids and women terrified, and out comes a guy, 6'4", flight suit, helmet with a visor down, carrying an M60 on his hip, takes his helmet off, his skin's black, big white teeth, low voice. They know what this guy was. It's a monster, And there are instances where, in different areas, we ran into a lot of problems. Marine Corps had less problems because we learned how to work with the people real well. But if you're in an area and you're working with a Vietnamese unit and you're a captain and he's a captain, they continue to worry about losing face. Because you've been trained, we need to go over here, we need to beat feet over here, we need to call in some artillery support here, get some gun cover and a medevac bird over here, let's go do it. And the captain said, no, I'm in charge, it's my country. And this liaison, some people work very well with it. The Green Beret worked excellent with it. The Marine Corps and their pacification program worked well with it. We would go into villages, then call Stars and Bars, bring Marine Corps band in, bring doctors in, do all this kind of stuff. And worked on getting the hearts and minds. That was a big thing, the hearts and minds of the people. There were other times where we didn't do that. But the South Vietnamese government was corrupt, in my opinion. There were some good people in it, too. Ironic, in Dallas, I have some friends in a restaurant that are Vietnamese. I have some friends here that are Vietnamese, and a friend of mine here is a doctor, Dr. Nguyen. He sat at a dinner this last spring. Remember the guy in Saigon, the chief police, who put the gun to the guy's head and shot him? He lives in Dallas, the guy that did it. He sat at the table with Nguyen Cao Ky, who was the Air Force general that later became president of the country, and my friend sat between him and that guy. The whole table was all that we see on TV. They're living in America now. Those guys are good at what they did. People don't realize, that guy that shot that man in the street, that man was the one who had been the head of the sapper team that assassinated half this guy's family. He could have died. See, and it was a misunderstanding, too, between the Vietnamese and the Americans. When he did that, his assumption was the Americans were griping about getting these guys out of here and cleaning them up. I've got one. I'll show the Americans our intent to fight. Blows his brains up. So what happens in America? Oh, how can you do this? It's cruel, unnatural punishment. It's murder. And on TV, here's Mildred Swiss sitting there eating her casserole on TV dinner, and all of a sudden the guy's brains fly out a hole and the blood starts spurting, and she's losing her cookies and her lunch, her dinner. How can they do this to us? So I think there were good ones and there were bad ones. Overall, there was no stable government from week to week. And a lot of guys are getting rich. Different warlord type. The warlord concept's very big in Asia, so they're getting rich. Whereas North Vietnamese are very dedicated. Nobody has anything, we're going to go down there and do it. So I think that we had I know one time I came home from flying, from February, I quit flying helicopters and flew C-117s, old DC-3 Dakotas modified, but there was a flare ship. So I flew up north on rescue missions with downed Air Force pilots. I came home to our building, I lived in the French Fort in Da Nang at this time, near Da Nang Air Base. Watched my hooch, my mama-san was huddled in the corner of the floor, and she was crying, and I walked in there, and I had on my flight suit, my shoulder holster, my .45, and you carried a gun everywhere. It was like a tool. It wasn't like some macho thing. It was like carrying a screwdriver or your wallet. I walked in the room, and she didn't speak much English. I said, mama-san, get up. What's your problem? And she's huddled. Went over and got her face all black and blue, her nose is bleeding. And I picked her up, and she didn't weigh about 50 pounds. Anyway, she's a little thing. Picked her up, put her in my bed, and she had beetle nut teeth. I said, what on earth is happening here? No can talk. Number 10, over and over and over again. I said, what is going on? And she said, they beat me. I said, who, Americans? She said, no Americans. I can't talk. It's dangerous. You must leave. And all this kind of jazz. I walked out in the hallway, and as I walked out in the hallway, I saw a Vietnamese boy about 16 years old. This will kind of tell the whole story about corruption. About 16, 17-year-old Vietnamese boy, a pair of nice slacks, a pair of loafers, no socks, and a kind of Aloha shirt on. Had some papers in his hand. Another kid down the end of the hall, about 17 or 18. They saw me, and they froze. They didn't even think to take my pistol out. I was so mad. I had mom sign my arm. I said, "Those the guys?" She said, "Yeah, number 10. Pushed her back in my room, closed the door, and I told them, "Freeze." They started to run, long hallway. I yelled top of my lungs. I said, I got some gooners. See, that's a terrible word because I mean, it's racist and it's not good. That's what we call them, zips or gooners. Got gooners in the hallway. The guy at the end of the hall throws open his door, comes out with his 45. This time I pull my 45 out and lock and load these guys, and they freeze. But they froze right next to a doorway, and it zipped out the door. We're both standing there, you know, geez. Meanwhile, they got nabbed outside the door by a couple other guys that heard us yelling. Grabbed these guys, I went back in, took a shower, got my mama's son cleaned up, sent her home, got my junkie toys on, walked out, and my roommate came in and said, "You need to be out in the compound, the general's out there right now." Walked out, they had these two guys handcuffed to a flagpole. All the officers, all the troops that weren't on duty, this is the headquarters of Marine Corps Air in Vietnam, three-star general named Armstrong, chief of staff, everybody's there. My boss calls me over, his colonel, assistant chief of staff, he says, "PJ, you saw these guys beat mouth?" I said, "Yeah, yeah. You got a field report tomorrow, yeah." Cool. Gates open up, in comes two South Vietnamese tanks, two deuce and a half trucks, and a Jeep. In the Jeep, dressed up, is this elite, they were air cav, armor type guys, South Vietnamese army, gold ascots, I think, with a pin on it of some kind. Real short guy gets out to general. I'm standing there, you know, they call their attention, we come to attention. And the flag pulls up the American flag, right next to the Vietnamese flag, and then the Marine Corps flag, and something else. He comes up, looks at the flagpole, spits at these guys, walks over to the general, starts to apologize to his interpreter. These guys are both Viet Cong infiltrators. They're putting out pamphlets, and they're putting drugs in people's locker to discredit officers and all this kind of jazz. Our general's saying, "Hey, we're sorry, you know, what can we tell you?" And all this kind of jazz. This guy asked for these two kids. Our general says to him, "What are you going to do with them?" That's my problem. Got this major standoff between my general, who's already called Washington, and already talking to the Pentagon, the Marine Corps, and the Air Force, and everybody and his mother. What are we going to do with this guy? And to make a long story short, he says, "I want to make sure these guys get treatment." And this guy says, "They'll be treated under South Vietnamese law." Well, come to find out, that one kid was that general's son. Okay? That's what came out later. I don't know if it's true or not, but that's what came out later. Our general says, "Okay, take him." They go to the end, they pull up a deuce and a half to the flagpole. Hot and all blazes outside. It's about 95 degrees. The humidity's real high. They untie these kids, and these guys are all really tough elite army types with spit-shine boots and everything. You know? They pick these kids up, and they throw them in the back of this deuce and a half. Their heads hit the... Oh, man, it was sick. Beat them up inside. This truck drove off. They found their bodies in a canal the next day. They were murdered. That general was sacked. Kicked out. How the staff was fired, discredited. So a lot of problems that way. I guess that's why, you know, this is a particular story or something I saw.
Right. The other, I had one more question.
I have to flip this over.
Yeah, go ahead and flip it over. It's about to run out. Okay. Another question I had was possibly, were you involved in Tet? And if so, was there... A lot is written about the strategic surprise that they really...
I was writing about, that was in January 68, February 68. I got there in summer 70.
Okay.
I've read a lot about it, and I've talked to people about it, but I wasn't there. My personal opinion was they knew for quite a while there was a buildup. They didn't know what it was. They never anticipated that North Vietnamese were going to move into the country with what they considered to be 25% of their forces, that all the locals would join them, make a people's army, and push them in the ocean. They also were not aware. Interesting enough, Saigon was caught completely by surprise. I mean, they were at the U.S. Embassy. It was a big face-losing thing. As far as the Vietnamese concern, it was terrible, picture-wise. The Marine Corps recovered very quickly, and the bloodiest fighting was all over the country. The bloodiest fighting was in Wei Phu Bai and securing Da Nang. But I think that the Marine Corps and different army units, intelligence units, have been writing all along. So they act together, something's coming down. But in Washington, they wouldn't believe it. And it did more damage on a moral point of view than it ever did strategically. Strategically, it was the major victory for American forces in Vietnam. It really was. All the books say so nowadays. So.
And I guess one of the final question here is, what effect do you think Vietnam had on both the country from the end of Vietnam to now, and also maybe in possible relation to the United States policy toward Central America?
Oh, yeah. We've never been in a situation like that. We never, when I came back, I served two tours in Vietnam. I was on the team that went to North Vietnam in 73 to bring the POWs out from Hanoi. I was on a carriage and minesweeping with helicopters and stuff. And the reason I went back on that mission, I came back to the States as a flight instructor. I couldn't stand living in the States. I never got spit on, but I got treated very rudely. When I got off the airplane in 1971 in June, it was raining at Travis Air Force Base, pouring rain, and I was the only officer on board. There were myself and 120 enlisted men. The sign says, "Welcome home, Soldier America's Pride," was broken and hanging, banging against this window in this building. The two jerks that were the sergeants that were to receive us, got them all in the room. Guys were wet. They had nothing to... No umbrellas, nothing. These guys walked 50 yards off an airplane in the rain. Supposed to be in their uniforms. That's all they had. We're told they couldn't go out in the street. They got clean. It was a joke. Sat there in the front seat of this thing, wet, myself. It was Army and Marines, and they had all their orders. These two guys are smoking cigarettes and leaning against the wall. And finally, I walked over to them. I was a lieutenant at the time. And I said, "Now, what time's the show getting in the road?" He said, "Well, we don't do it except on the hour. It's 20 minutes to go. I said, you're going to do it now." I was angry. I think I'd have beat the garbage out and gone to jail for it. I said, get your behinds up there. That's exactly what I said. Get this thing going. We'll talk to our officer. I got the second lieutenant. I said, "Listen, jerkweed, get up there and get your guy. I got this captain who outranked me." He says, "Who do you think you are?" I said, "I got 130 men here. And none of these guys that were doing this are Vietnam veterans. You can tell by the ribbons. One of them was surely highway ribbon, you know, national defense ribbon. It's really made me mad. I said, "These men are ringing. If I have to go call somebody in Washington, I'll do it. Let's get going." Then the whole attitude of cab drivers was a big shock coming to America. And it was rode airplane. I got an airplane one time, and it was in uniform just after that. And some drunk was on board getting a bunch of flack. So I mopped off the stewardess. So I reached over and grabbed him by the tie and took the back part of his tie and pulled his tie as I could get it. I said, "If you don't shut your face, I'm going to shut it for you." I carried his anger around. Went home. My family today, if you were to talk to them, would say everything a family could do wrong with returning that we did. Forget about the war and all this. I'm sitting eating dinner my first night home. Got a cut in my hand that I got in the helicopter door. Wasn't even healed yet. Still had sunburn and some skin problems from Vietnam. Still had, in the shower, still had some, you know, it takes a while to get that red dust off you. Still had that. I mean, to me, Vietnam was right here. It was right down my shoulder. To my family, it wasn't. The American people just despise the soldiers so bad and the war. Girls wouldn't go out with you because you know, your hair was short and you killed people. Especially if you're a vet. Especially if you're a volunteer. I mean, it's just terrible being an American. I haven't seen the movie Born on the 4th of July. I can watch Vietnam movies. I thought Platoon was great and all that. But I can't stand watching protests when I get really mad. People just say bad things about my friends that died and all this kind of jazz. I believe that the War Powers Act, to me, is unconstitutional. But because the power of Vietnam is so strong, they won't repeal that. I think our government is deathly afraid to get back involved in something like that. That's why I think the thing at Panama was good. It shows how you can do it right. It was right. Get in there. I mean, to do a night airborne assault in a country like that is just, for anybody having military experience, all is awesome. Awesome thing. To lose a few casualties is awesome. And that was clean. But of course, all those folks that were in there were all elite. 82nd Airborne, 101st Airborne, Marine Recon, Special Forces. It was all the top people. They know what they're doing. But America has gotten snake bit by this thing. And it tempers everything we do. You know, Algeria, the one in Vietnam. I never saw too many senators' sons or congressmen's sons in Vietnam. Captain Rob, who was Lyndon Johnson's son-in-law, was in Vietnam when I was there. You know. But I never knew any congressmen's sons, any rich guy's sons too much in Vietnam. They weren't there. But those are the guys that all the time griping back in the States about it. So I think they're so deathly afraid of our national image. You know, we lost the war in Vietnam. But what's happened is, the Vietnam Wall being built. I think I met the fellow who was responsible for it, Jan Scrubs. He was here, and he autographed this book I got at the wall. And Jan autographed it. Many thanks to a fellow vet. They walked up the table. Vets, no vets. And I walked up, and you can tell somebody's not for trying to be a nice Jan Pat King. I said, "That's what Marines and soldiers. I was a so-and-so." And we talked for about an hour. About life and things, and that was a powerful thing. And we finally, after all those years, when veterans went into hiding, a whole bunch of Vietnam veterans groups tried to group in the 70s and early 80s, never worked. because there was no common acceptance like the Legion and all that. And the Legion didn't want you. And that because of the fact that we're two guys, green guys, we were winners, you're losers. Well, now that all this history's come out and all this writing and all this stuff is happening, it all of a sudden has dawned on people that, hey, these guys are good at what they did. They do what their country asked them to do. There's a separation between what these guys did and what happened. And that's been amazing. Now there are only two or three Vietnam groups that are strong. The strongest is the aviation groups. They're very strong. I don't know why. The government, I believe, has never known how to handle this situation. How can you lose something? If you look at all these different videos and things, a lot of these guys who are secretaries of defense and ambassadors have tried to somehow separate their involvement with what happened. Somebody messed up. It's obvious Lyndon Johnson wasn't a very strong guy. As much as I thought Richard Nixon was kind of a crook in some things, General Giap said they were terrified when Nixon took over as president. Justifiably so. When I got to North Vietnam in the spring of 1973, February 1973, and went to Haiphong Harbor, I'll tell you a little secret I don't think people know about. When we went up there with the ships, the head of the minesweeper detachment was a guy named Art Bucher, who was the captain of the Pueblo. Remember, they got captured by the Koreans, and it was a big scandal and all that. One night, at the officers' club at Suga Bay in the Philippines, there is a big officers' club. It was a small officers' club for single guys. It was rowdy. I mean, we're talking rowdy. My roommate Pete Ferris said, I want you to meet somebody and stand over the bar having a drink, because this is Art Bucher. This is my roommate Pat King. We're on the same ship, and my other friend, Randy. And we sat there and drank with him, played pool, got to know Art Bucher pretty well. Terrific guy. We went into Haiphong Harbor in February. Art Bucher led the squadron of three minesweepers in to do a path for our carrier. And Art went in there, and we got it all clear. The Navy jerked him off, kicked him out of the Navy, put another guy in there, and the headlines had the other guy's name in it. That's typical of the military's point of view. Art Bucher embarrassed. See, he was a loser. He did everything he was supposed to do, except he didn't sink his ship and die with his ship, which is maybe traditional. A lot of guys didn't do that. But Ark embarrassed America. The American forces embarrassed America, supposedly. That was the big excuse. All of them were a bunch of dopers. The guys were guys like me and you. I didn't smoke dope in Vietnam. I drank a lot. It doesn't make me any better than anybody else. But they're just guys like your dad, my dad, me, you, people in the street, people you know at tech, your professors, the average guys doing a very strange thing called war, combat. And all the movies where the guys are kind of weird and freaking out. Most guys, I had a crew chief like that. I took him almost at gunpoint on my helicopter. He got out of the helicopter and took his gun right out of his hands. A crew chief took his pistol out and held him. The guy was strung out in drugs, put him in, got him kicked out, he was gone. We can't have guys like that, you know. But I mean, it was just guys every day, 9 to 5, gutting it out. Combat is not getting shot at one time and surviving. Combat's doing it day after day. And just doing it and trying to keep him losing your mind. So the American people just kind of, I think the American people saw in themselves what Shakespeare wrote about people. They saw the animal underneath. How you can train men. Your next door neighbor, Billy, shoots an 8-year-old kid in the head. Blows his head clean off his shoulders on national TV. The kid had C4 strapped around his waist, going to blow up something. Or he's gonna. They used to take and put crushed fiberglass in Coke bottles. The guys would drink it and hemorrhage and die. You know, somebody comes right out of a hooch, what do you do? It isn't like a line with all the guys, like Germans in uniforms or tanks. You don't know who it is. I've killed women and children. And I will say this, Lieutenant Cayley, by and large, most soldiers I knew at the time did not condone what Cayley did. To line up a bunch of kids and women in a ditch and shoot them was wrong. But to be fired on the village, but then it's a moot point. The village, there's a big firefight on, you roll in and you blow it up with one bomb, you kill women, is there a difference? Yeah. One thing they all comment about, when Jane Fonda went to North Vietnam, I was in Vietnam when she did that, and that picture came out of her on the gun thing, there were guys that were volunteering and take their guns and go get her. I mean, I knew guys that fly to Hanoi and a Huey gunship and hose Jane. To this day, I will not watch her in a movie. I don't care whether about her exercise videos or anything. I think she's a waste. And I think she's a traitor. When she made this big apology last year to apologize to soldiers, the guys that said, Jane, you're a jerk. You know, not saying that Jane is a jerk. Two different points of view. But I believe that the American people, because of their fear and their disgust and their dread of what they saw in themselves, sold a whole generation of men. One thing about Vietnam was really weird, too. In World War II, the average age of a soldier was 27. Korea, like 23, 24. Vietnam, 18. 75, 18, 19. It's different. Seeing all that age. But I think what happened now in Central America and things, we're so afraid of committing ourselves. George Bush did us a favor, I think, with the Panama thing and his people. Hey, you can do it. And nobody in America is sweating it. Even the liberals aren't. They're not sweating that. It's Nicaragua thing. They all know Noriega is a crook, but it's kind of in. Still have that from that liberal image. So that's kind of how it answers that question, I guess.
Okay. Well, I guess that's about all the questions I have. I appreciate you doing this for us. Let's go ahead and
finish
the tape.
Here. We need to beat feet over here. We need to call in some artillery support here. Get some gun cover and a medevac bird over here. Let's go do it. And the captain of the news guy said, no, I'm in charge. It's my country. As this liaison, some people work very well with it. The Green Beret worked excellent with it. The Marine Corps and their past mission program worked well with it. We would go into villages, then call Stars and Bars, bring Marine Corps band in, bring doctors in, do all this kind of stuff. And worked on getting the hearts and minds. That was a big thing, the hearts and minds of the people. There were other times where we didn't do that. But the South Vietnamese government was corrupt, in my opinion. There were some good people in it, too. Ironic, in Dallas, I have some friends in a restaurant that are Vietnamese. I have some friends here that are Vietnamese, and a friend of mine here is a doctor, Dr. Nguyen. He sat at a dinner this last spring. Remember the guy in Saigon, the chief police, who put the gun to the guy's head and shot him? He lives in Dallas, the guy that did it. He sat at the table with Nguyen Cao Ky, who was the Air Force general that ever became president of the country, and my friend sat between him and that guy. The whole table was all that we see on TV. They're living in America now. Those guys are good at what they did. People don't realize, you know, that guy that shot that man in the street, that man was the one who had been in the head of the sapper team that assassinated half this guy's family. Like, I mean, he could have died. See, and it was a misunderstanding, too, between the Vietnamese and the Americans. When he did that, his assumption was, the Americans have been griping about getting these guys out of here and cleaning them up. I've got one. I'll show the Americans our intent to fight. Blows his brains out. So what happens in America? Oh, how can you do this? It's cruel, unnatural punishment. It's murder. And on TV, I mean, here's Mildred Swiss sitting there eating her casserole on TV dinner, and all of a sudden the guy's brains fly out a hole and the blood starts spurting, and she's losing her cookies and her lunch, you know, or dinner. How can they do this to us? So I think there were good ones and there were bad ones. Overall, there was no stable government from week to week. And so a lot of guys are getting rich. Different warlord type. The warlord concept is very big in Asia, so they're getting rich. Whereas North Vietnamese are very dedicated. Nobody has anything, you know, we're going to go down there and do it. So I think that we had I know one time I came home from flying. From February, I quit flying helicopters and flew C-117s, old DC-3 Dakotas modified, but there was a flare ship. So I flew up north on rescue missions with downed Air Force pilots. I came home to our building. I lived in the French Fort in Da Nang at this time, near Da Nang Air Base. Watching my hooch, my mama-san was huddled in the corner of the floor, and she was crying, and I walked in there, and I had on my flight suit, my shoulder holster, my .45, and you carried a gun everywhere. It was like a tool. It wasn't like some macho thing. It was like carrying a screwdriver or your wallet. I walked in the room, and she didn't speak much English. I said, mama-san, you know, get up. What's your problem? And she's huddled. Went over and got her face all black and blue, her nose is bleeding. And I picked her up, and she weighed about 50 pounds. Anyway, she's a little thing. Picked her up, put her in my bed, and she had beetle nut teeth. I said, what on earth is happening here? No can talk. Number 10, over and over and over again. I said, what is going on? And she said, they beat me. I said, who, Americans? She said, no Americans. I can't talk. It's dangerous. You must leave. And all this kind of jazz. I walked out in the hallway. And as I walked out in the hallway, I saw a Vietnamese boy about 16 years old. This will kind of tell the whole story about corruption. About 16, 17-year-old Vietnamese boy, a pair of nice slacks, a pair of loafers, no socks, and a kind of aloha shirt on. Had some papers in his hand. Another kid down the end of the hall, about 17 or 18. They saw me, and they froze. Didn't even think to take my pistol out. I was so mad. I had mom sign on my arm. I said, those are the guys? She said, yeah, number 10. Pushed her back in my room, closed the door, and I told them, freeze. They started to run, long hallway. I yelled top of my lungs. I said, I got some gooners. See, that's a terrible word because I mean it's racist and it's not good. That's what we call them, zips or gooners. I got gooners in the hallway. The guy at the end of the hall throws open his door, comes out with his .45. This time I pull my .45 out and lock and load these guys, and they freeze. But they froze right next to a doorway, and it zipped out the door. We're both standing there, you know. Jeez. Meanwhile, we go up. They get nabbed outside the door by a couple other guys that heard us yelling. Grabbed these guys, I went back in, took a shower, got my mama's son cleaned up, sent her home, got my junk utilities on, walked out, and my roommate came in and said, you can be out in the compound, the general's out there right now. Walked out, they had these two guys handcuffed to a flagpole. All the officers, all the troops that weren't on duty, this is the headquarters of Marine Corps Air in Vietnam, three-star general named Armstrong, chief of staff, everybody's there. My boss calls me over, his colonel, assistant chief of staff, he says, PJ, you saw these guys beat them outside. Yeah, you got a field report tomorrow, yeah. Gates open up, in comes two South Vietnamese tanks, two deuce and a half trucks, and a Jeep. In the Jeep, dressed up, is this elite, they were air cav, armor type guys, South Vietnamese army, gold ascots, I think, with a pin on it of some kind. Real short guy gets out to general. I'm standing there, you know, they call everybody's attention, we come to attention. And the flag pulls up, the American flag, right next to the Vietnamese flag, and then the Marine Corps flag, and something else. He comes up, looks at the flagpole, spits at these guys, walks over to the general, starts apologizing to his interpreter. These guys are both Viet Cong infiltrators. They're putting out pamphlets and they're putting drugs in people's locker to discredit officers and all this kind of jazz. Our general's saying, hey, we're sorry, you know, what can we tell you, and all this kind of jazz. This guy asks for these two kids. Our general says to him, what are you going to do with them? That's my problem. Got this major standoff between my general, who's already called Washington, and already talking to the Pentagon, and the Marine Corps, and the Air Force, and everybody and his mother, what are we going to do with this guy? And to make a long story short, he says, I want to make sure these guys get treatment. And this guy says, they'll be treated under South Vietnamese law. Well, come to find out, that one kid was that general's son. Okay? That's what came out later. I don't know if it's true or not, but that's what came out later. Our general says, okay, take him. They go to the they pull up a deuce and a half to the flagpole. It's hot and all blazes outside. It's about 95 degrees. The humidity's real high. They untie these kids, and these guys are all really tough elite army types with spit-shine boots and everything. You know? They pick these kids up, and they throw them in the back of this deuce and have their heads hit the... Oh, man, it was sick. And beat them up inside this truck, drove off. They found their bodies in a canal the next day. They were murdered. That general was sacked, kicked out. How the staff was fired, discredited. So a lot of problems that way. I guess that's why, you know, it's a particular story or something I saw.
Right. The other, I had one more question.
I have to flip this over.
Yeah, go ahead and flip it over. It's about to run out. Okay. Another question I had was, possibly, were you involved in Tet? And if so, was there... A lot is written about the strategic surprise that they really...
I was not about... That was in January 68, February 68. I got there in summer 70.
Okay.
I've read a lot about it, and I've talked to people about it, but I wasn't there. My personal opinion was they knew for quite a while there was a buildup. They didn't know what it was. They never anticipated that North Vietnamese were going to move into the country with what they considered to be 25% of their forces, that all the locals would join them, make a people's army, and push them in the ocean. They also were not aware. Interesting enough, Saigon was caught completely by surprise. I mean, they're at the U.S. Embassy. It was a big face-losing thing. As far as Vietnamese concern, it was terrible, picture-wise. The Marine Corps recovered very quickly, and the bloodiest fighting was all over the country, but the bloodiest fighting was in Wei Phu Bai and securing Da Nang. But I think that the Marine Corps and different army units, intelligence units, have been writing all along. So they act together, something's coming down. But in Washington, they didn't want to believe it. And it did more damage on a moral point of view than it ever did strategically. Strategically, it was it was the major victory for American forces in Vietnam. It really was. All the books say so nowadays. So.
And I guess a final question here is, what effect do you think Vietnam had on both the country from the end of Vietnam to now, and also maybe an impossible relation to the United States policy toward Central America?
Oh, yeah. We never been in a situation like that. We never... When I came back, I served two tours in Vietnam. I was on the team that went to North Vietnam in 73 to bring the POWs out from Hanoi. I was on a carrier minesweeping with helicopters and stuff. And the reason I went back on that mission, I came back to the States as a flight instructor. I couldn't stand living in the States. I never got spit on, but I got treated very rudely. When I got off the airplane in 1971 in June, it was raining at Travis Air Force Base, pouring rain, and I was the only officer on board. There were myself and 120 enlisted men. The sign says, Welcome Home, Soldier America's Pride, was broken and hanging bang against this window in this building. The two jerks that were the sergeants that were to receive us, got them all in the room. Guys were wet. They had nothing, no umbrellas, nothing. These guys walked 50 yards off an airplane in the rain. Supposed to be in their uniforms. That's all they had. We're told they couldn't go out in the street. They got clean. It was a joke. Sat there in the front seat of this thing, wet myself. It was Army and Marines, and they had all their orders. These two guys are smoking cigarettes and leaning against the wall, and finally I walked over to him. I was a lieutenant at the time. And I said, now, what time's the show getting in the road? He said, well, we don't do it except on the hour. It's 20 minutes to go. I said, you're going to do it now. I was angry. I think I'd have beat the garbage out and gone to jail for it. I said, get your behinds up there. So I made it what I said. get this thing going. We'll talk to our officer about the second lieutenant. I said, listen, jerkweed, get up there, get your back. Got this cap. Go out rank me. He says, who do you think you are? I said, I got 130 men here. And none of these guys that were doing this are Vietnam veterans. You can tell by the rivers, one of them was Shirley Highway River, the National Defense River. It was really made me mad. I said, these men are ringing. If I have to go call somebody in Washington, I'll do it. Let's get going. Then the whole attitude of cab drivers was a big shock coming to America. And it was real airplane. I got an airplane one time, and it was in uniform just after that. And some drunk was on board getting a bunch of flack. So I mopped him off the stewardess. So I reached over and grabbed him by the tie and took the back part of his tie and pulled his tie as I could get it. I said, if you don't shut your face, I'm going to shut it for you. I carried his anger around. Went home. My family today, if you were to talk to him, would say everything a family could do wrong with returning that we did. Forget about the war and all this. I'm sitting eating dinner my first night home, got a cut in my hand that I got in the helicopter door. Wasn't even healed yet. Still had sunburn and some skin problems from Vietnam. Still had, in the shower, still had some, you know, it takes a while to get that red dust off you. Still had that. I mean, to me, Vietnam was right here. It was right down my shoulders. My family wasn't. The American people just despise the soldiers so bad and the war. Girls wouldn't go out with you because you know, your hair was short and you'd kill people. Especially if you're a vet. Especially if you're a volunteer. I mean, it's just terrible being an American. I haven't seen the movie Born on the 4th of July. I can watch Vietnam movies. I thought Platoon was great and all that. But I can't stand watching protests when I get really mad. People just say bad things about my friends that died and all this kind of jazz. I believe that the War Powers Act, to me, is unconstitutional. But because the power of Vietnam is so strong, they won't repeal that. I think our government is deathly afraid to get back involved in something like that. That's why I think the thing with Panama was good. It shows how you can do it right. It was right. Get in there. I mean, to do a night airborne assault in a country like that is just, for anybody having military experience, it's an awesome, awesome thing. To lose a few casualties, they did, it's awesome. And that was clean. But of course, all those folks that were in there were all elite. 82nd Airborne, 101st Airborne, Marine Recon, Special Forces. It was all the top people. They know what they're doing. But America has gotten snake bit by this thing. And it tempers everything we do. You know, I was young, one of the Vietnam. I never saw too many senators' sons or congressmen's sons in Vietnam. Captain Rob, who was Lyndon Johnson's son-in-law, was in Vietnam when I was there. You know. But I never knew any congressmen's sons, any rich guy's sons too much in Vietnam. They weren't there. But those are the guys that all the time griping back in the States about it. So I think they're so deathly afraid of our national image. You know, we lost the war in Vietnam. But what's happened is, the Vietnam Wall being built. I think I met the fellow who was responsible for it, Jan Scrubs. He was here, and he autographed this book I got at the wall, and Jan autographed it. Many thanks to a fellow vet. They walked up the table. Vets, no vets, and walked up. And you can tell somebody's not for trying to be nice. Jan, Pat King means. I said, that's what the Marines and so I was a so-and-so, and we talked for about an hour. About life and things, and that was a powerful thing. And we finally, after all those years, when veterans went into hiding, a whole bunch of Vietnam veterans groups tried to group in the 70s and early 80s, never worked, because there was no common acceptance like the Legion and all that. And the Legion didn't want you, and that because of the fact that World War II guys, Green guys, we were winners, you're losers. Well, now that all this history's come out, and all this writing, and all this stuff is happening, it all of a sudden has dawned on people that, hey, these guys are good at what they did. They do what their country asked them to do. There's a separation between what these guys did and what happened. And that's been amazing. Now, there are only two or three Vietnam groups that are strong. The strongest is the aviation groups. They're very strong. I don't know why. The government, I believe, has never known how to handle this situation. How can you lose something? If you look at all these different videos and things, a lot of these guys who are secretaries of defense and ambassadors have tried to somehow separate their involvement with what happened. Somebody messed up. It's obvious Lyndon Johnson wasn't a very strong guy. As much as I thought Richard Nixon was kind of a crook in some things, General Giap said they were terrified when Nixon took over as president. Justifiably so. When I got to North Vietnam in the spring of 1973, February of 1973, and went to Haiphong Harbor, I'll tell you a little secret I think people know about. When we went up there with the ships, the head of the minesweeper detachment was a guy named Art Bucher, who was the captain of the Pueblo. Remember, they got captured by the Koreans, and it was a big scandal and all that. One night, at the officers' club at Subic Bay in the Philippines, there is a big officers' club. It was a small officers' club for single guys, because rowdy. I mean, we're talking rowdy. My roommate Pete Ferris said, I want you to meet somebody and stand over the bar having a drink, because this is Art Booker. This is my roommate Pat King, we're on the same ship, and my other friend Randy. And we sat there and drank with him, played pool, got to know Art Booker pretty well. Terrific guy. We went into Haiphong Harbor in February. Art Booker led the squadron of three minesweepers in to do a path for our carrier. And Art went in there, and we got it all clear. The Navy jerked him off, kicked him out of the Navy, put another guy in there, and a headline said the other guy's name in it. That's typical of the military's point of view. Art Booker embarrassed. See, he was a loser. He did everything he was supposed to do, except he didn't sink a ship and die with a ship, which is maybe traditional. A lot of guys didn't do that. But Art embarrassed America. The American forces embarrassed America, supposedly. That was the big excuse. All the movies are a bunch of dopers. The guys were guys like me and you. I didn't smoke dope in Vietnam. I drank a lot. It doesn't make me any better than anybody else. But they're just guys like your dad, my dad, me, you, people in the street, people you know at tech, your professors, average guys doing a very strange thing called war, combat. And all the movies where the guys are kind of weird and freaking out. Most guys, I had a crew chief like that. I took him almost at gunpoint on my helicopter. I got out of the helicopter and pulled him, and took his gun right out of his hands. My crew chief took his pistol out and held him down. The guy was strung out in drugs, put him in, got him kicked out, he was gone. We can't have guys like that, you know. But I mean, most people, it was just guys every day, 9 to 5, gutting it out. Combat is not getting shot at one time and surviving. Combat's doing it day after day. And just doing it and trying to keep them losing their mind. So the American people just kind of, I think the American people saw in themselves what Shakespeare wrote about people, they saw the animal underneath. How you can train men. Your next door neighbor, Billy, shoots an 8-year-old kid in the head. Blows his head clean off his shorts on national TV. The kid had C4 strapped around his waist, going to blow up something, or he's going to... They used to take and put crushed fiberglass in Coke bottles. The guys would drink it and hemorrhage and die. You know, somebody comes right out of a hooch, what do you do? It isn't like a line with all the guys, like Germans in uniforms or tanks, you don't know who it is. I've killed women and children, and I will say this, Lieutenant Cayley, by and large, most soldiers I knew at the time did not condone what Cayley did. To line up a bunch of kids and women in a ditch and shoot them was wrong. But to be fired on the village, but then it's a moot point. The village, there's a big firefight on, you're rolling and you blow it up with one bomb, you kill women and children, is there a difference? Yeah. One thing they all comment about, when Jane Fonda went to North Vietnam, I was in Vietnam when she did that, and that picture came out with her on the gun thing, there were guys that were volunteering and take their gunship and go and get her. I mean, I knew guys that fought a Hanoi and a Huey gunship and hose Jane. To this day, I will not watch her in a movie. I don't care whether about her exercise videos or anything. I think she's a waste. And I think she's a traitor. When she made this big apology last year to apologize to soldiers, the guys that said, Jane, you're a jerk. You know, not saying that Jane is a jerk. Two different points of view. But I believe that the American people, because of their fear and their disgust and their dread of what they saw in themselves, sold a whole generation of men. One thing about Vietnam was really weird too. In World War II, the average age of a soldier was 27. Korea, like 23, 24. Vietnam, 18. 75, 18, 19. It's different. Seeing all that age. But I think what happened now in Central America, things, we're so afraid of committing ourselves. George Bush did us a favor, I think, with the Panama thing and his people. Hey, you can do it. And nobody in America is sweating it. Even the liberals aren't. They're not sweating that. It's Nicaragua thing. You know, they all know Noriega's a crook, but it's kind of in. They still have that from that liberal image. So that's kind of how it answers that question, I guess.
Okay. Well, I guess that's about all the questions I have. I appreciate you doing this for us. Let's go ahead and
okay.
Finish the tape.